Welcome to The Gary Knoll Show, an informative program dedicated to improving personal and public health.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com.
I'd like to say hello to everyone in this audience. I'm Gary Knoll. Always nice to be able to share positive insights into different aspects of how we function in health and disease. On this particular program, we're going to explore something that actually began years ago. And one of the more exciting and dynamic and original investigations, a gentleman who's my guest, Cleve Baxter, was able to work with plants and human blood cells. And in 1966, he discovered that living cells tune into and can communicate with their environment and people in that environment. They can respond to your emotions, even when a blood cell is out of the body and you've left the room and you're in another part of town. Whatever you're thinking and doing can cause some form of conscious communication. How's that possible? We're going to explore that today. Cleve Baxter has finally written the whole story from his first chart-recorded encounter with a cane plant to his development of a method of detecting communication with human cells in vitro. And some of what you might read in his book, The Secret Life of Plants, and some of his other work we're going to talk about. His current book is Primary Perception, Biocommunication with Plants, Living Foods, and Human Cells. Nice to have you with us today, Cleve.
Thank you.
Cleve, you may not, I'm sure you don't recall this, but a long time ago, I was working on an in-depth investigative report, and it had to do not with plants, but it had to do with the Romanovs, the Tsar of Russia, the Tsarina, Olga, Tatiana, Anastasia, and Maria, and the son, Alexia, the last of the royal family of Russia. And I was working on a story that showed that they did not end up murdered at Ekaterinburg in the basement, shot and buried in a mine, but rather that they escaped, and that what the world was told was a very well-conceived plot, and that we were able, through Robert Speller, my publisher, and his sons, and through a whole group of people, including the British Member of Parliament, Peter Bessel, and others, and Guy Richards, a well-known city editor for the Journal American in New York City, we were able to put together this. I wrote a book on it. Richards wrote a book on it. They wrote a book on it. And your name came up because I believe, unless I'm mistaken, that you were the polygraph expert who they wanted to see was the woman that they were interviewing who claimed to be the Anastasia, the real Anastasia. There were two claimants. One was Eugenie Smith, the other was Anna Anderson. One, the Anna Anderson character, had been portrayed by Ingrid Bergman in the film Anastasia. The other was unknown. And it was your polygraph readings, your lie detector test, that convinced the Spellers and others of the legitimacy of her claims. And anyhow, we're not here to talk about that today, but do you remember that?
Absolutely. This consumed 7 years of my life during that investigation. In fact, I still have the tape recordings where we had Anastasia confronting Alexa after she'd sort of deserted the family and moved to the West. And this in three different languages and lots of crying and weeping apologies.
And was that the Alexa, the young hemophiliac son, was that Colonel Michael Golianeski, the former head of Polish intelligence?
Yes. I'm not sure that he was head of Polish intelligence.
Well, an officer.
Yes, in fact, he became sort of a friend for a number of years.
Well, our paths cross once again, because at the time you were doing following your research at the Institute of Applied Biology, I was doing work on the living energy of foods, and for different reasons. I was looking to see whether or not the energy of foods could enhance the human's energy, and I did a whole series of experiments over a two-year period where I determined that if foods on a scale of 1 to 10, if they were 8, 9, or 10, could actually help in the reversal of disease by repairing DNA and fortifying the immune system, like juices and sprouts and living foods, and that if they were below 5, they could sustain life but would not reverse disease and would not prevent disease. And if they were below 3, they were going to lead to disease. And then I did an analysis of the average American. I did over 500 Americans' diets, and their average life energy was about 3, which was giving me a good indication that these people were going to end up getting sick with heart disease and cancer and arthritis. And it was purely predictive. Nobody wanted to accept the science, even though it was meticulously done, because they just didn't want to believe that you could predict the disease based upon the energy variances in what a person took in. And then I did the energy variances when people were stressed. My work did not get published at the time because the Institute of Plant Biology's directors did not accept it, even though it would later show it would be absolutely correct. Yours did get published and was very important, and so I just wanted to acknowledge the good work that you did, and I'm just wondering how many other people were doing work of a similar nature. Let's go right to that work now and talk about it, because most of this program is going to be you discussing the nature of your work, much as if we are a classroom. You're going to educate us step by step, because this is going to be all new material for most people in here, and we're going to talk about primary perception. So please begin by explaining what is primary perception.
Well, primary perception is something in my evaluation that is even more basic than the so-called extrasensory perception. It's something that's very basically there with everything. And it doesn't require any special talents and so forth, just a question of working out an electrode configuration to be able to balance in on instrumentation the material you're working with and watching the electrical signals that are manifested. And this seems to be very, very, very basic, much more basic than just the somewhat unusual extrasensory perception.
Tell us why understanding this perception, primary perception, is important, and what role would mainstream science have in trying to determine this idea that primary perception exists? Why haven't we heard about it sooner from major institutions?
This is a good question, because I've been working with this since 1966, and this is certainly a big mystery to me, because if the intentions of the scientists are being picked up by the biological material that the scientist is working with, that would seem to be awfully important. And I'm getting every indication and, you know, scientific evidence and good solid chart recordings that show this is the case, that the expectations and emotionality of the experimenter is being monitored by the biological material that's involved in the experiment.
But show us how that actually applies to someone's life. Why would someone right now listening to this program be interested in the whole concept of this perception, primary perception?
I think that the topic of holistic health would be most involved. In other words, the experimentation that I've done has shown that there is an alternate communication capability with every cell of your body without going through the central nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, and that if this is true, it means that your emotional changes are being picked up immediately and directly by billions of cells in the body. And this being the case, it could be very, very important that you watch the quality of your thinking.
Because what you think your body will become? Cleve?
Yes.
Because of what you think your body will become?
Well, if you have nothing but negative thoughts, in other words, I found in the monitoring of these cells in vitro or separated from the donor, that negative thinking causes a very strong electrical discharge that shows up in the charts. Now, this, of course, means that the cells in the body are also experiencing the same phenomenon. And of course, this is not healthy because it's upsetting the electrochemical operation of these cells.
On a more practical level, I think everyone who has a pet in this audience understands that they can communicate easily with a pet, non-verbally with a pet. The pet seems to understand what you're feeling, and it responds in kind. Tails wag, tails go between the legs, eyes look up, eyes look down, eyes avert. Is it possible that we are communicating non-verbally with everything around us? We just don't understand how they're receiving and what we can respond, how we can receive in return.
Yes, I suspect this strongly this is true. And, of course, the average human is unaware that this is going on. I know that the work was done by Rupert Sheldrake over in England with dogs. It was very, very interesting because he found that when a person left to return home at odd times where it wasn't the same every day, that the dog, at the very moment that he made the decision back at work to go home, the dog would go to the front door. And so he did some coordination and time calibration with cameras on the place at work and also the front door at home, and found out that this was true. Now, this is very interesting because the dog is certainly tuned in. It's just perhaps the humans are out of the loop.
Well, let's also talk about this, and please give us much more of your information, much more of the depth and breadth of your knowledge on this. Again, let's start by the idea that we're just a class. We have 45 minutes. I want you to take us step by step through this whole process of what it means to understand how we communicate or don't communicate, or what we're communicating that we're not aware we're communicating. Because if primary perception is correct, and I believe it is, then it also means that remote viewing is doable and remote healing. Healing at a distance. In fact, I did a study at the Institute of Applied Biology where we took 50 healers, we gave them mice, and half the healers lived out of the country. I had Olga Worrell, and I had Harry Edwards, and Doris Collins, and George Pasteur, and all these American and European healers, and repeatedly those individuals were able to heal the mice from a special type of cancer, and they did it purely by remote healing. Now, science can say, well, we don't believe what they did, but science must accept that a phenomena occurred that was repeatable 6 out of 6 times. So if that's the case, then it means that we can do this. So think of the implications of sending positive thoughts, sending healing messages, the power of prayer. So take a step by step through this whole phenomena so we can better understand it, understand its implications, understand the process, and understand how we can learn it.
That's a big task in a short period of time.
Well, I'm not going to interrupt you. I'm going to leave it to you just to take us step by step now, all right?
The thing that I've tried to do, in fact, in this book that I finally wrote, a book of my own, which I don't care for writing that much, but I stepwise went from the event that initially got my attention. In fact, it's the thing that sort of tripped off all of the direction of my research later on. And this is back in New York City when I just watered a Dracaena cane plant in my polygraph laboratory, and I became curious as to how long it took water to get from the root area of this plant up through the long trunk of a Dracaena cane and out to the end of the long leaves. And so I thought, well, gee whiz, as the water arrives after the plant has been given the saturation watering, the water, as it will arrive in the leaf should become a better conductor. And if I have some instrumentation attached to that leaf that measures resistance changes, I should be able to check the rate of rise of the moisture. And so I had plenty of polygraph equipment there back in New York because we ran a polygraph school, as I still do. And so I attached two of the contacts or electrodes that we use with humans, one on each side of the leaf, and bounced the leaf in. And instead of getting a direction as far as the tracing was concerned that I would expect, in other words, an upward tracing direction, as the resistance dropped, I got some contour, reaction contours that looked very similar to reactions I would get when testing humans with the galvanic skin response section of the polygraph. And pretty soon I started to catch on that that the plant very much was seemed to be attuned to my thinking. And this was became most dramatic. If you have that the book available, the cover of the book shows the tracing where about 13 minutes along in the initial observation, I thought, well, I know what I'm going to do that will affect the well-being of this plant. I'm going to burn that leaf. And the second of my intention of burning the leaf, the imagery of, that, of burning the leaf hit my mind. The pen just went right off the top of the page and went into wild agitation. And the building was empty. There was no one else in the lab. I wasn't touching the plant. Immediately, I could see right there that, gee whiz, it's like this plant read my mind. Now, that back in February 2nd, 1966, is the thing that kicked off my interest. So from that point on, I did some long-term monitoring of plants where I wasn't trying to make the plant do things to show me, but I was just going to do monitoring to show what the plant would, what the tracing would look like, just monitoring the average happenings in my laboratory area. And one thing led to another where it led to discoveries that that showed that not only the plant was attuned to the human emotionality, it was attuned to other life forms in the lab, starting right down at the bacterial level and going on up to chicken eggs and a whole number of things that that started to show capability of reaction. And so as this occurred, I developed a way of electroding each of the various things that seemed to be showing some kind of sentience or equivalent of emotional change. And this led all the way up through not only doing a lot of work with chicken eggs and the live bacteria and yogurt, the healthy bacteria in yogurt, then to animal cells, and then finally to human cells tested away from the donor. And these, by merely putting gold wire electrodes in a sample of these cells, we're able to get the emotional change of the donor reflected in the tracings, even though the donor may be located either a short distance away or even long distance away. So the plant was the occasion that there was just no other alternate explanation to explain what was going on, and it really caused me to face up to the idea that something important was happening, and it just developed over the period of years, all the way up to now, the involvement with human cells.
Okay, but keep it rolling here because we're learning. Now let's take it to what it means to, all right, you were able to show that what you were thinking, the plant picked up on. There was a sense of communication. Now, since we know that there's no universal truth that is only isolated, that all universal truths can be universally applied, that means that every plant, it means that every animal and every human is equally susceptible to the same form of communication. Now see how that will then translate to where how we treat our pets, how we treat other people, how we even treat the developing baby. Think of all the women who don't want to have babies, who want to have an abortion, and think of the trauma then that sends into the developing fetus.
Once you become comfortable with the idea that this communication exists, all of the things that you listed, plus a lot more, seem to come into play. In fact, the very basis of the idea of saying a blessing over food before you ingest the food could be the food's chance to know your intention and go into an insensitive state before it's ingested. And in testing various kinds of food, I found that the food is quite capable of doing this. It will go into a sort of a flat line on the tracing if there's a threat to its well-being. And, of course, in holistic health, you can see that your negative thinking and all of the extraneous discharge that's going on at the cellular level is certainly going to be disruptive and would be would certainly affect the health of an individual. Now, once you have started to wonder what the nature of this communication is, one of the things I've said over the years, I've told the scientists that have inquired, they say, well, what is the nature of this communication? And I say, well, look, the only way I've kept peace with the scientific community is not to try to give an explanation, because my inadequate explanation could be shown to be flawed, and then my good observations will be thrown out with my bad explanation. So it wasn't until the quantum physicists came along and there was a discussion of non-locality that it started to clear up a good bit of what I'm dealing with. Now, non-locality in quantum physics involves a kind of equivalent to communication that does not consume time and does not have distance limitation. In other words, instead of thousands of years to go a significant distance across the universe, communication would be instantaneous. And of course, this and its implication as far as spiritual values of prayer and meditation are concerned seem to me to be pretty profound.
Let's just explore that in some depth, how it can implicate. Because at the end of the day, people are going to say, okay, what you're saying is that plants can communicate with humans, humans with plants, though we frequently are not sensitive enough to pick up on this. Humans can communicate with humans non-verbally, but again, unless you're sensitive enough, you're not going to know that you are actually communicating. What does it mean for me? And that's where I want to start.
It seems that from the bacterial levels on up through plants and chicken eggs and so forth and so on, there's no problem in those levels communicating with humans. But now for the reverse communication to occur, where the humans are picking up from these other entities, it's not so easily accomplished. And, of course, one of the reasons is that a person is totally convinced they can't do that to begin with, which can create some problems. But it's sort of a pecking order, and I think that somehow people will be able to experience in a practical way their capability to do this when they're more able to handle the information they're going to obtain. And until they're ready to do that, it seems like as though they may be deprived of that capability.
So in other words, if a person's not ready in their own consciousness to be open to this, then that channel will not vibrate at a certain level because it's all energy. So the energy is blocked. Now here's a question to add on to that, and I'd like to hear you explore this. Before a person quits a job physically, they've quit it emotionally. Before a person leaves a relationship physically, even discusses it with their partner, they leave it emotionally. Before we commit a crime physically, we commit it emotionally. We have to justify it. We have to rationalize it. We have to bring it into our consciousness. We have to give ourselves some excuse that says, okay, I can do this. And from the period of time when we start a thought process that leads us to an action, maybe days or years, but during that period of time, the energy that was associated with the change that we occurred in our mind, irrespective of what we're showing to the public, putting on the smart face to the public or the nice emotions, but it's the real emotions underneath from the time that we initiated it that is really being projected. Think of the implications if people could pick up on these subtle energies when there is discord, when there is imbalance. Long before anything is discussed, we could be way ahead of the game and be able to help resolve conflicts where we didn't even know there was a conflict, resolve problems where people are building up a frustration level. They're feeling it emotionally, but they're not expressing it verbally. Your thoughts, please.
Well, once you become aware that this communication capability exists, then the monitoring of individuals, especially in therapy sessions and things of that nature, where you're actually doing physiological monitoring of the person's cells in vitro, et cetera, one should be able to learn how to pick up on these discord that would be showing, because the imagery of what a person is thinking seems to be a mode of communication, to where it is the imagery that's translated to the biological monitor, not the words that are being spoken, but the imagery that precedes the words being formulated. And as a monitoring device, I would think this would be certainly a very valuable tool.
Now, this is a little more esoteric, but certainly very important for this audience. And by the way, for this audience, I'm Gary Nall. You're listening right now to Cleve Baxter, B-A-C-K-S-T-E-R, who did a very famous experiment, as he told us at On February 2nd, 1966, at 13 minutes and 55 seconds into the chart recording of this plant, his whole consciousness changed. And from that, a lot of us have also learned from his work. When you sit down to eat a steak, that cow was fully aware that it was going to be killed. We're now eating horse meat. If you've ever looked in the eye, the last thing that every horse will do before it's slaughtered is it looks directly into the eye of the person cutting its throat or ripping open its belly. It's communicating why. Cows, pigs, highly conscious that they are being killed. I've filmed animals. I have them in two documentaries I've done on animals being killed. Now, by extension, and here's where we get into the hypothesis. So it is. There is no such thing as humane slaughter. That's an oxymoron. It does not exist. I don't care if it's a rabbi or anybody else who says, well, you know, it's a painless death. Nonsense. That's a lie. That's a vicious, vicious pathological lie. It's okay if you want to justify eating meat, but don't say that the animal didn't suffer so you could have its protein, which you didn't eat anyhow. And my work at the Institute of Applied Biology, the first, by the way, in the United States, showed that all vegetables have complete protein. All fruits have complete protein. All grains and legumes, nuts. So there's no reason whatsoever to have animal protein in our diet. But be that as it may, when you understand the terror that an animal is going through, anticipating its own helplessness and its death, then what does it tell us about the energy that's in the meat that the person eats, and what does that energy mean to coming into our system? That is a factor I would like to have you express and expound on.
Well, you know, it's interesting that in the portion of the book when I wanted to deal with human cells being tested in vitro, I went back to some of my old experimentation. And one of the things I hadn't even wanted to talk about, because this happened way back in 1966, the same time the initial plant observation occurred, I was curious about whether the cellular level in meat, for instance, that it, of a cow, an animal had been slaughtered, whether I could balance that in and work out some electroding problems that would help me later on to be able to test the human cells in vitro, namely blood or even human sperm or things of that nature. And so the thing I did, I went to the meat market and I got some fresh beefsteak, and this had not been frozen before, and I took the sample back to the lab and I divided it in two. And I froze half of that sample, and the other half of the sample, I took a sliver of the beef, and I put it between the electrodes and bounced it in on my EEG-type equipment. EEG-type equipment is really just a high magnification of electrical discharge at cellular level. The EKG is a less sensitive instrumentation for measuring the electrical activity of the heart, and then EEG is usually the more conventional use is for brainwave study, but the thing that I found is that I was getting communication capability of the cells in this meat of the deceased animal that was still alive, and they were still communicating, because when I put some slivers of the meat down on the floor for my cat to eat, at that time I think it was a Doberman Pinscher that I had at first, and then later on I had some work with Siamese cats. But initially, with the Doberman Pinscher, started to eat the meat. The slab of meat that I had between the electrodes showed a huge reaction. And then when I was cleaning up the board that I'd used to cut up this meat, and there was blood on this board from the cutting of the meat, when I poured Ajax on that blood, the sliver of meat that I had between the electrodes showed huge reaction. And I have the actual little charts from that in the chapter leading up to the animal cell work in the book. And at that time, I had been a little bit amiss from the idea of they're calling me the plant man, and I didn't know what they'd call me if I was starting to talk about, the meat showing reactions. And so I never talked about that for years and years until I was preparing the material for this book. So what you bring up is interesting, because there is a consciousness at the cellular level in this meat And until it actually, I imagine when it spoils, perhaps you would get less or no meaningful tracings. But you can take a slab of mead and put it between electrodes for EEG, and anyone can do this. It's not something that's so odd. And you're going to get electrical activity. You're going to get a reaction from one sample of that mead to another sample of the mead. So this brings up some interesting aspects of your theory also.
I look at universal truths, which, by the way, contrary to many scientists, especially in Washington, D.C., actually supersedes human truth. And I do not accept human truth because it's so fallible and it's so filled with contradiction. But if there's a universal truth that life should be respected, and if this universal truth shows that consciousness can be exchanged and communicated and shared, then it would be no different eating a piece of meat than eating a human. If you were to have a human piece of flesh that were taken off a person that just died, for instance, I'm sure that you would find a very similar pattern of activity where the consciousness was in the cell and the cell was aware of its environment and the intent of those in the environment, which shows that there's an interconnection between consciousness. So replace the leg of lamb with the leg of human, or your dog or cat, and which you would not do, and because you would consider them more more spiritual, because they know you, they communicate with you, yet you don't know the cow, and you assume that it's just a dumb animal. And I'm saying the cow, the calf, the lamb, the deer. I'm adamantly opposed to hunting. I think it's something that a person should reconsider. Why they're hunting and what they're trying to prove by their hunting, some primordial urge for dominance or aggression, you know, it's, and especially, God, these guys that go out in a truck and stand in front of a, you know, an elk and just, that's on a game farm that's just munching away and shoot it. And I'm just wondering if they would appreciate what would happen if the whole world were able to see, gee whiz, you mean this piece of meat knows it's going to be eaten by your Doberman or eaten by you? Well, if it knows, now here's the tricky part, Cleveland, here's where I've done my work. I believe that if the presence of the energy knows that you're about to eat it, and if it's in high-level agitation, it's going to cause high-level agitation because it's going to become a part of the genome of your own cell. And then that's going to cause an agitation that's going to lead to a disease. No different, I might mention, than thinking about a stressful action and suddenly that whole action comes right into your being and you then take on all the characteristics of that stressful action. So I believe that we should not be eating meat. I don't believe we should eat anything with a face or a heartbeat. I believe that when we do that, we're taking on the energy and the energy is manifesting in a disease process, however long it may take, but it's creating disharmony at the cellular level. That's my thoughts. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think I've given you a vehicle to further research your thoughts right down the line, because I don't think it's occurred to anyone to electrode samples of meat from a deceased animal. But there is lots of activity going on there, and this would be a vehicle to pursue some of those thoughts in a manner that should be interesting research. Now, when you get the plants, we've got a little problem with plants now, where, of course, the plant would like to stay alive. And the idea, people have often asked if my research is a threat to vegetarians, and when I've tried to say, well, I don't think you could think of an equivalent situation in animal life where the animal would gladly give up a portion of its being. Perhaps transplants might be an exception that needs discussing there, but the animal wants to stay intact. But now with plants, the leafy part of the plant is going to mature, fall off, and become just part of a compost heap if it's not consumed. And I think there is a advantage so that the leafy part will be consumed by the human, become part of the human existence. So, but the root area, I think that some vegetarians feel that you should preserve the root area because that wants to survive and produce more leaves. I don't know how you feel about that.
Okay, well, I believe that there's another concept to this, and that is that in the larger scheme of life, we could not live without life. And that if you look at who are the healthiest people on the planet, who are the healthiest in our society, it would be the vegetarians. It would be those people who eat living foods, who think positive thoughts, who exercise the body to increase its overall vital energy, and therefore subscribe to what would be known as the vitalism philosophy. Vital energy is a law of similars, much like homeopathy. So anything that creates a vital energy is enhancing the well-being, including vital consciousness. So if we accept that all life requires substance, and this substance that we're giving for the substances has to have qualities allowed to exist, then nature's provided the brilliance of life from the fruits, the vegetables, the nuts, the seeds, the grains, legumes, to us, because when you take in a glass of wheatgrass juice, or you take in a bowl of brown rice, or you take in a fresh bulb of garlic, or onions, or some cherries, you'll find that you'll have a spike in the vital life force, that your energy is enhanced substantially. We can show that it offers a way of preventing disease, living longer, repairing cells. Now, the fact that the cell of the plant, like broccoli, has a capacity to block, it will help block the cancer production. It will help repair DNA. Watermelon will help repair the cell's DNA so the cell can live longer. I have not found that to be true with any animal protein whatsoever, not from the egg, not from cheese. I believe that it's there to be a synergistic enhancement of bringing energies together as a form of entropy. In other words, if you have 15 people working together in a concerted way, you can create music where it's magnified from the 1 to the 15. Whereas if you go through life without bringing energy from anything else in, you die. So I believe that the energy is there for us, but you have to be very selective in the energy you bring in. No different than a relationship. You bring in a man, if you're a woman, into your life, let's say, for our argument's sake, and you bring in the right energy, and it enhances your energy, and the two energies are vibrating at a high time, you're going to have passion, joy, happiness, love, and a dynamic platform from which you can create whatever you choose. Two people, however, coming together where one or both of their energies is not balanced, and now you have disharmony, arguments, fighting, demeaning, using, betraying, and you feel it. How many times has a person said, "I know you're cheating"? Well, how do you know I'm cheating? I felt it. Yeah, well, what's the proof beyond feeling it? That's no proof. Well, I felt it. And then indeed, it turns out that they were right. So I believe that we should look at this whole idea of harmonizing energies, and therefore the plants of our life are what harmonize our life energy. I did this work at the Institute of Applied Biology where I had three groups of rats. And by the way, I never did vivisection work at all. I never did a single experiment ever that caused harm to an animal. To the contrary, all the work below me at the Institute was done in cancer research, and they were doing chemotherapy and radiation. And so what I would do is I'd go down at nighttime when the lab was closed, and they had marks on all the cages for which of the rats were to be killed. And the guys would come in early in the morning, and they'd take these rats and put them into a big drum and just suffocate them. And so I would take these rats, and I'd mark a little check that they had been taken care of. But instead of killing them, I'd take them upstairs, and I'd nurse them back to health. Well, I found that the way I can help a rat overcome the radiation they'd been exposed to, or they all seem to have these little patches. They'd make a patch on their back and burn it, and then how quickly it would graft together would determine whether or not the medicines they were using worked. But I did it all with nutrition, and I found that certain things I could give them would speed up their healing. Now, once they got healed and I could save the rat, then I did something a little different. I would give it a challenging environment. Instead of having a little tiny cage, I'd give it a big room to run around in. And I would put the food in different places and create real challenging terrain for it to have to get to the food. And every day I'd make it different. Well, these rats live 30% longer than the normal lifespan just by the challenging the environment and healing their body. And they were all over the place. And they would respond to me very favorably. A lot of them, one of them in particular, would sit right on my shoulder as I worked and just wouldn't move. I mean, all night long, just be sitting here on my shoulder. And then I did this experiment, and this is what you got to listen to. This is important. I interviewed over 500 medical doctors and nurses over a period of 2 months. I got a list of their foods. I then made up a diet in the lab each day, and I gave it to a group of rats to see if the doctor's diet, who were supposed to be the most knowledgeable about health, would be an advantage. Unfortunately, it was not. It was a disadvantage. They got overweight. They were sick. And rather than see them suffer, I got them off the diet and got their health back. But the group that I gave a living foods diet, where I put fresh-made organic juices and instead of water, and I gave them grains and nuts and seeds, they lived 50% longer. They were thinner, more energetic, and never reverted to cannibalism. And I might mention, when the rats were fed the diet and kept in cramped quarters, frequently they would revert to cannibalism. Never had that happen with a group that had the expanded open environment. So I learned a lot from that. But I still believe that the energy they were getting that was enhancing their own energy allowed them to live a longer life. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I can see the rationale with your line of thinking there, and that doesn't surprise me, although, of course, you always have the hard-nosed scientific types that want all the proof. But I think that once you are aware that there is a kind of perception that I've called primary perception, that can tell you that you have whole new avenues to try to affect the well-being of the living things you're working with, and also to monitor the changes within these substances. To me, I just don't understand how I've been doing this research since 1966, what's over 35 years. And the idea of the scientific community sort of turning their back on this and not even looking is, to me, amazing, absolutely amazing. I just don't understand it. It's just something that, to me, is so obviously important, and it's something that they can also replicate. I've had hundreds of people replicate these observations. But one of the problems you get into in my kind of research is that there is a conflict between repeatability and spontaneity. In other words, if what you're doing where you're seeking possible reaction is not spontaneous, you don't get the reaction. If it's spontaneous, you do. Now, there's nothing that is less spontaneous than a repeatable experiment. And therefore, to try to get, in other words, you might get a nice reaction the first time that something occurs, but then when you try to get that 10 times in a row, because the scientific method says that is necessary, this isn't going to lead to success. So you've got this big problem in consciousness research where repeatability and again, the simultaneous nature, or the spontaneous nature of what you're trying to study just don't go together, and it creates loads of problems.
Well, I think it's very important that we at least understand this research has been done. There are some very credible people who are doing this over at Yale University. A professor over there has done it. Chairman of a department has done it. In their own way. And they're all coming pretty much to the same basic conclusion, that energy is not limited by space and time, that all of us are capable of connecting with energy, and at the higher levels of this energy connection, we manifest a greater sense of harmony within the body, mind, and spirit. We can connect with other people. We can help ourselves not be stressed out. We can help ourselves heal. I just finished working yesterday with a top psychologist author and professor from California who has terminal cancer, and he spent a week with me. And it was only when I did some energy work on him that suddenly everything changed, absolutely everything. And I've been doing this energy work my whole life, and it's a gift that I got from my mother. And we spent the day talking yesterday about this, and he said, I've never felt this good. I feel absolutely that I've learned a lesson about my cancer. And I said, what's the lesson you learned? He says, I've spent my whole life trying to figure out everything for everyone else, and I have not paid attention to what's been essential to myself. I've made everyone else come first, and then I come second. And I realized that because I've been denying myself a chance to thrive within my own life, that I have processed this cancer. So now that I understand that I process this cancer by the indifference that I had in my life, by the stressors I was adapting to in my life, and hiding it all behind working nonstop, I can now apply myself to reversing this. He said, I feel absolutely optimistic. For the first time in a year, I feel I understand why I got sick, and I understand fully the direction I have to take in reversing this process and learning the lesson of it. And he said, I thank you, Gary, because I had no idea there was a lesson in this cancer, especially terminal cancer. And he said, now I understand there is a lesson. Well, there's a lesson in everything we do. Absolutely everything has a lesson if we're open to the energy of it, not just the cause and effect of the actual organic consequence, but long before there was a cause and effect, there was a conscious choice. And then there was an energy choice. What happens if the energy, the primal energy, the spirit energy says, no, don't do this, and the overriding conscious energy says, yes, I want it. Now, which of those two energies is going to win out? And what will be the consequence to going against your own energy? I believe that we have a conscious energy, which is conditional and highly functional to our day-to-day lives. And I believe that we have a deeper spiritual energy. And it's getting in touch with that deeper spiritual energy that allows us to make less of the mistakes that we make. Your thoughts, please.
Well, getting in touch with is like paraphrasing communication. So I think it does boil down to a communication problem. And to me, a lot of times I've often thought of cancer cells, for instance, of being cells that were out of communication, and like the psychotic individuals in public, but in the body. And if you can restore communication, that could have an awful lot to do with reversing the condition. And yes, indeed, I can see your line of thinking down the line. I can see how it does dovetail with the kind of thing that I'm working with, that I'm calling the primary perception, because some of the things that you're mentioning also seem to tie into the quantum physicist's definition of non-locality, that it isn't restricted by time consumption or distance limitation. I think we're sort of on the same wavelength here, that where one of us can use the concepts of the other, perhaps, to pursue further research. One of the things I want to do now, I'm trying to get some funding to help to do this, is, oh, by the way, one of the things we should mention before we run out of time is that people can get an awful lot of information about the research that I'm doing by just tapping into our website. It's called primaryperception.com. And there's a lot of information. It's a very active website that's kept up by my editor and publisher, Francie Prowse. And you get a lot of information there. But the thing that we're very anxious to do now is a research project we were doing with a human subject, simultaneous recording of the three conventional polygraph parameters that are used in polygraph testing, along with the electroencephalograph, and also added to this a fifth tracing that would relate to cells from that same person being tested in vitro or away from the donor, and to see what is particularly that fifth tracing, if we're getting correlation between the reactions that are showing on the cells in vitro along with the conventional readings that we're used to using in research with human beings, that this would be an awfully important breakthrough, and it would be very, very difficult for the scientific community to ignore.
Good idea. I'm going to see if we have time. I want to take a call or two, so I'm going to ask your engineer, could you get out a number so people could call in and join me? I'm Gary Nalkley. Baxter is my guest. We're talking about a topic that needs a lot of discussion. It is called primary perception and what happens about the energy that is able to be communicated in nonverbal ways and the communication between humans and humans, humans and animals, humans and plants, and vice versa. So we'll see if we have someone calling in. Also, I think that if you look around the world, every culture in the world, no matter how separated from any other culture, when a child is born, the mother brings the child up to her lips so she can kiss it. And one of the reasons I believe a kiss is so important is because the energy that's exchanged. There's also molecules exchanged. That's how a baby develops its immune system, through the saliva of the mother, who then creates the antibodies and then produces the breast milk, and the breast milk has the antibodies. Well, wouldn't that also follow exactly what we're discussing, is you have a molecular communication that alters what is needed in order to create something that sustains and enhances life.
2-0.
Let's see if we have... We're looking for people to call in right now, even though we're coming up the end of the nearest show. And while someone's calling in, could you answer that, Cleve?
Well, we'll put that in the... Hello?
Hi, go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Yes, my name is Bernest, and I heard earlier you guys were talking about the embedded psychic impression that animal life has, and when you consume it, you may take on some of its negative characteristics in yourself. I also heard what you were saying also about the necessity for life, take life, you know, consume life and so on, and therefore validating, you know, consuming plants and so on. But there is some evidence to show that, you know, I mean, where do you draw the line? Because plants have kind of a consciousness too, as far as, you know, observing things and as far as, you know, having a sense of, well, they don't know if it's morality or what, but they do have a sense of response to things that's in their environment.
You're correct. And it's a good point, but consider this, that the whole idea of being the happy chef, the happy farmer, the happy person, when we were sprouting in the laboratory, we would do a room of sprouts and we would meditate over the sprouts, and prayer and meditation over the sprouts by Rabbi Abraham Wiseman, a Dr. Thomas Kruth of the Seminary St. Luke's, and other individuals, a chiropractor, Dr. Morton Jacobs, Dr. Dolores Krieger, who founded the Therapeutic Touch, all show that those sprouts increased almost double in size. And there was a greater vitality in the sprouts when they were consumed. So when something is growing to become a part of the individual, then their life is not ending. Their life is continuing in the individuals that are consuming them, because the energy cannot be destroyed. Energy can only be diminished or enhanced. So, therefore, they're there for the purpose of our enhancement. How we treat the plants, how we consume the plants, how we prepare the plants has a great deal, I believe, to do with the quality of the energy that is expressed.
But isn't the cholesterol and the toxins and all those things going to become a part of you when you consume meat products and so on?
Yes, it is, and that's why I don't believe that we should be consuming meat products, because you're not going to have that elevation from in cholesterol or triglycerides, C-reactive protein, fibrinogen, or homocysteine from consuming plants. In fact, the five leading causes of congestive heart failure and coronary artery disease and atherosclerosis, C-reactive protein, homocysteine, LDL cholesterol, fibrinogen, and triglycerides, you're getting that from animal proteins, not from plant proteins. So we look around at why we're dying, and you could substantially reduce the cause of death if we simply made that shift. Okay, thank you for your call. I appreciate that call. I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to take more calls. We will on our next program. We're coming up to the end of this program. I want to thank you very much, Cleve Baxter, for being on and sharing. And I'm going to be doing a series of new experiments on feeding experiments to humans based upon this energy, and also a new way of measuring life force in foods and juices and other things. And I'll be in communication with you in case there's something we want to share in common on that, all right?
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed our conversation.
My guest, Cleve Baxter, a gentleman who has done some extraordinarily original work, work that has stood the test of time and has been a springboard for so many other people. I certainly appreciate all of his good work. His book is called Primary Perception, Biocommunication with Plants, Living Foods, and Human Cells. I'm Gary Nall. I wish you all an outstanding day and I look forward to sharing more on our next program. And you can all go to GaryNall.com for more information on a lot of topics, and it's there free and as a public service. Have a good day, everyone.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from BP, which is working to provide today's energy while transitioning to a low-carbon future. More information at bp.com/US.